Hello out there, Morris speaking. It's December of 2019, and that can mean but one thing. It's time for the annual Love That Album First Time Listens episode. Did I say episode? I meant episodes. I'm breaking this up into two parts. So normally what happens is we have one episode that's devoted to my music journalist friends, and then there's an episode where I will speak with someone in the community who normally does a podcast with me. And in this case, it's going to be my son Max. He was on the show a couple of months ago speaking about the album by Cardiacs, Sing to God, and we had such a fun time doing it, and he really wanted to come on and talk about the albums that drew him in this year that I thought, why not? So we'll do a separate show about that, and that'll probably be out in the last week of December 2019. But this time around, I am joined by my good friends and music journalists, Jeff Jenkins and Mr. Ian McFarlane. Both gents gave very freely of their time to talk about albums that came out this year that they really loved. And in Ian's case, he also spoke about some albums that he'd heard before but hadn't listened to in a long time and how that made him feel. So that is really, really interesting stuff. At least I found it so anyway, and I hope that that is the case for you. There's a lot of Australian material, but there's also some stuff from overseas as well. So you Northern Hemispherians won't feel, hey, who is this? But even if there is a lot of stuff that you've never heard before from the Australian artists, well, you've got some stuff to learn. Hope you enjoy. Anyway, what we'll do is we'll go to a quick break. Joanne will give you the contact details, and then we'll get straight into Jeff and Ian's recountings of their favourite first-time listens of the year, and I'll be back at the end of the show to talk about what's going to happen in part two of the program, which will be released, as I said, in the last week of December. We'll be back shortly. You're listening to Love That Album, episode 129.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm...
We hope you're enjoying the show. You can find previous episodes of Love That Album at lovethatalbum.blogspot.com, or you can get it along with any of the other great music discussion shows at rockandrollarchaeology.com, all part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. To keep up to date, subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. You can email Morris with feedback or album suggestions at rrrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. Join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/lovethatalbum and start a music-related discussion.
Through the records an hour or two, and I've about decided what I've got to do.
Hello and welcome back to episode 129 of the Love That Album podcast. As I like to do at this time of the year, I love to go and speak to people about their favorite discoveries of the year. It can be albums that were released that year, or it can be something that you discovered from an earlier time. And one of my regulars, and the man who was on the very first episode of Love That Album way back 8 years ago or something like that, music journalist Mr. Jeff Jenkins, welcome back to Love That Album.
And they said it would never last, Mo, and here we are.
It was you that said it would never last.
Episode 129. Congratulations.
Thank you very
awesome.
Much. Thank you very much. So the reason that I'm here at Shea Jenkins is to find out your favourite albums of 2019. I don't know, are they all 2019
albums? Yes, they are. Maybe a couple of anthologies we might mention. But yeah, it's an annual tradition now.
It has become. I'm so glad that you're still part of it.
This year just went by ridiculously fast. A couple of weeks ago when you said to me, oh, let's get together, it's time to do the best of for the year, I was like, oh my God. You know, my headspace wasn't in doing sort of a wrap-up of the year. But I'm there. I'm ready to go.
Good. Okay, well, let's hear what you have first. I'm pretty sure I know what one of them is, and I'm fairly confident I know what a second one is, but let's see where we go.
Well, I'm going to count them down from 5 to 1. Mm-hmm. So, number 5, I love this record this year, Dyson Stringer Chloe. We snuck in to see the band. Sounds like a law firm, but it's actually an indie supergroup. Mia Dyson, Liz Stringer, Jen Chloe, and all very different artists. And when the first single came out from this record, I wasn't overly excited. I don't
Falling Clouds.
Yeah, Falling Clouds, which are a tribute to two great Australian bands from the 90s, the Falling Joys and Clouds, both fronted by women. So it was a celebration of that sort of indie rock sound of the 90s. I don't know why I wasn't excited. I think it was just, I don't know, whatever headspace I was in at that time, because I now think it's just a great song. But it was only when I got the album, and then I put the album on, the first couple of tracks have that sort of slacker pop vibe from the 90s. But then as the album goes on, it kind of goes off into different directions. There's an incredibly beautiful track called Can't Take Back.
Now the days seem to be bleeding into one another, and the words that you are speaking don't reach me, they don't mean a thing.
Which to me, it's like a classic Bonnie Raitt track. It's just achingly beautiful. Blew me away. So I just thought, yeah, a wonderful record that I just kept returning to. For some reason, it just kept drawing me back in, and I kept discovering new things from playing it.
I'm a big fan of Liz Stringer. I really...
Yes, for many years, you've followed her work.
Got a couple of her albums, and I've seen her live, and yeah, she's terrific. But I'd never sort of really given much time to Jen Kloer, and I'd heard Mia Dyson a bit, and yeah, I thought, yeah, she's good, but there's something about the three of them getting together. It just worked so well, and it was recorded in
Chicago
in Wilco's studio.
Yeah,
Glenn Cocci.
Yes,
on drums, and it does sound like, at least from a production perspective, like a contemporary Wilco record. But that's a good thing. But it's still very much all their own, and it's a warm sounding record.
Yeah, just a beautiful, beautiful record, self-titled record from Dyson Stringer Kloer.
Hopefully there'll be another one before too long. I'd love to hear them work together again.
Yeah, and there was another Seeker Lover Keeper album. Speaking of sort of supergroups, that's Sally Seltman, Holly Throsby and Sarah Blasco. They made a beautiful record this year, very much an adult contemporary record, but really classy collection of songs. I love that as well. But at number four, and I think this is an artist that you've loved for many years, like I have, Deborah Conway and Willie Ziga, a brand new album called The Words of Men in 2019.
There's a war that's coming, but you don't want to fight. Or maybe you'll fight me. Hey, that ain't right. The people in this neighborhood, they got better things to do. They think the fascists won World War II.
And it was a really exciting time being a Deborah Conway fan since the 80s. She put a version of Do Re Mi back together, and I got to see them live this year. That was fantastic. If people are not familiar with Do Re Mi, certainly check out Man Overboard, which was their classic single. But also
Wasn't that our national anthem for a period of time?
It was a very unusual pop hit back in the mid-80s, but a great, great song that still holds up today. And also a great song called Adultery, which didn't get as much attention, but a fantastic song from Do Re Mi. But this year, they did an anniversary show for the Bitch Epic album.
I was at that show.
Her second solo album. Fantastic show. It's a cliche, but with Deborah Conway, she could sing the phone book and make it sound magical. She is just an extraordinary singer.
Just want to also point out for anyone out there who may be Deborah Conway fans but might not know that Deborah and Willie's three daughters, they do harmonies absolutely beautiful. They worked with them on the album. I think Alma was the one who was not available to do the mid-year concert, but Alma is making something of a career. She's gone like back 60, 70 years and is doing
jazz.
Old jazz torch songs, and she has got an incredible voice. If you close your eyes, you don't know that you're listening to a 18, 19-year-old girl from Melbourne. An amazing voice, really well worth seeing, playing a lot on the Melbourne scene. So Alma Zigia as well. And I know that she'd be someone who Deborah and Willie would be extremely proud of.
How beautiful is it at their show and to see a mum and dad singing with their children? And this is a joy. And I was lucky enough to interview Willie Zigia this year and talk about it. It's an extraordinary partnership, he and Deborah Conway. Been together like more than 25 years now. Obviously make music together. They live together, they're parents. And then I said, what are you going to do after this tour? And he said, well, we're going on holidays, just Deborah and I. So they holiday together as well. So it's extraordinary partnership in Australian music, both incredibly talented.
Well, Bitch Epic was the start of their partnership.
I mean, it was.
It's not his name on the album. He was just guitarist for hire, I think, because Richard Pleasance had done String of Pearls and then
yes.
he moved on, Boom and Crash Opera, doing other stuff. But
classic story that Deborah was looking for a guitarist. She didn't know Willie, but he'd been recommended to her. So she sort of checked him out and offered him the gig. And he was like, oh, look, yeah, I can't really do the tour. Because he had a band called Tootyville, which were a really cool indie pop band in Melbourne. And he said, oh, look, I've got this gig with my band, so I can't really commit to the tour. And it was just like one gig at the Evelyn in Melbourne. And she was like, who is this guy knocking back a national tour to do a, you know, a shitty little gig at the Evelyn? So she was kind of intrigued by this. You know, and that was the start of their relationship because she was just like, who is this guy?
I remember several years ago, they both came on to Love That Album. We were talking about the album that had just been released at the time called Stories of Ghosts. But I went back and asked them about a song from Bitch Epic that I thought, this is really unusual. This is the first song that you wrote together now that we're apart.
And the irony.
Stab a knife into his heart. And it was the beginning of a relationship. That's the sort of song that you write at the end of a relationship.
I'm so mad. My hand is aching to plunge a knife into your heart. I want to see you bleed. I need to see you need me. Now that we're apart.
Great irony in that song.
Sort of points to the fact that a lot of songwriters, they don't always write biographically. A lot of the time it's just they have a great imagination. They're story writers. No one ever asks a book author what happened in your life to write this book, but they're always asking songwriters.
Yes, yeah, it is quite strange. What a lovely bloke Willie Zigger is as well. Because Deborah, something which is great about it, she's incredibly feisty and combative, which, you know, comes through in the music. On the new record, there is a song called I Need to Complain, which is a great song. Yeah. And so this record, The Words of Men, is kind of about, part of it is about getting older. There's a great sense of humour in there, but there's a fantastic song called Imperfect Words. And Deborah sings, I sing imperfect words, they roll off my tongue, I got something for everyone. And she does. She's just a remarkable artist. She should be in the ARIA Hall of Fame. And what a partnership with Willie Zigger. Any accolade she gets, she deserves. What an artist. I love this record, The Words of Men. At number three, another local singer-songwriter from Melbourne, Ben Mitchell.
Why do you walk so slow? No place to go. Why do you seem so sad? Things ain't so bad.
I first met Ben way back in 1990. Now, I've pretty much written about music my entire writing career, but I've written a little bit about television, not a lot, but a little bit for newspapers and magazines. This time when I met Ben, he was starring in a Channel 7 cop show called Skirts, which no one remembers, but it actually wasn't too bad a show. I think they might have only done the one series back in 1990, and he was playing a young cop in the show, so I interview him for the Herald Sun. Just a fantastic bloke, and we ended up talking a lot about music. So I remember walking away from it going, wow, for an actor, this guy really loves his music and lovely guy. Then he went on to star in Neighbours and he's written a couple of books. He lived in London for a long time. But of course, music really is his first love and he's made a few solo records. Ben Mitchell's brand new solo record is called Slow is the New Fast. It's a really gentle album, but to me, you know, it also packs a punch. And it's kind of like an album for the crazy times that we live in. There's a lot to this record. He made it with Matt Walker. He's an incredibly talented guy. Yeah, as I said, a very simple record, but very, very powerful record. He's got sort of a bit of a crooner's kind of voice. I played a track on the radio one night and someone sent a text in going, oh, he sounds like Marlon Williams, which is probably not a bad comparison. He's had great success. So just a lovely, lovely guy, Ben Mitchell. This this is his best album yet. I'm a big fan, and it's called Slow Is the New Fast.
This is my up-tempo number. You can dance to it. Gonna let my head down, maybe just a bit. 'Cause slow is the new fast.
Then at number two is another local artist. And there are so many, it's been just incredible in the last few years, the amount of young female artists just making incredible music, all quite different to each other. But this year, I love like the Montaigne album, Alex Leahy, Beck Sandridge, Olympia, Meg Mack, G-Flip, a wonderful debut record, Thelma Plum, what a year she had, a songwriting collaboration with Paul Kelly and Sir Paul McCartney, extraordinary. A local folk duo, The Maze, made a beautiful record.
Oh, I think I heard a track or two off The Maze. Yeah.
Beautiful record. But at number two is another local young female artist, Angie McMahon. Her debut album called Salt.
And they're building things outside my window. Everywhere I look, there's signposts, signposts. Just sit in my house making noise for fun. But I'm not moving much or proving much.
She did a few singles over a couple of years. This album, I was waiting for it. Then got the album. It's just a wonderful record. She's kind of at times really fragile on the record, but then really fierce. Her voice just has incredible presence. Her voice is the lead instrument on this record. The aching, the hurt, it's just extraordinary. And I remember talking when this record came out, because obviously there's a little bit, you know, Courtney Barnett is one comparison, but she has definitely got her own thing going on. And a friend of mine just said to me, it was interesting, like 10 years ago, every young female artist wanted to be Missy Higgins, who's just an extraordinary artist. And she said, now they all want to be Courtney Barnett, which shows what an influence and what an impact Courtney Barnett has made, not just locally, but internationally as well. As I said, Angie McMahon's definitely got her own thing going on. But if you are a fan of Courtney Barnett, definitely check out this album called Salt. Fantastic debut record.
Loving you has thrown me. You have been my
And at number one, I think this might be one you were expecting me to come out with.
I have a feeling it is.
It is an artist, I don't know if you've heard of him, called Bruce Springsteen. I don't know if you know him.
Some stuck out as I go. I'm just traveling up the road. Maps don't do much for me, friend. I follow the weather and the wind.
I don't know, has he done anything before?
Well, he's just starting out. Hopefully he'll make it. He seems to have had a busy year, and it really has been an incredible 12 months for Springsteen fans, considering the fact that he hasn't done a tour, of course. But this time last year, he put out the Broadway album, which was extraordinary. Then early this year, that ended up on Netflix, where we got to see it as well. Then the Western Stars album was released, which is my favourite record of the year. And then he made a movie, and there's a soundtrack album as well. So it's been an incredibly busy time, considering no tour.
There was a lot of talk on the internet, as you know, people talk on the internet. I don't know if you've discovered this. I can't remember which song from the album had been released, like as a, they don't call them singles anymore, we just whatever they released to the ether. And first time I heard it, I thought, oh my goodness, he's got orchestration. He's not done this. This is melodically rich. It's beautiful. It's heartwarming. I don't know if I discussed this with you, but I was never really big fan of his E Street Band projects throughout the noughts. So
the Magic album is incredible.
Sorry, Magic aside, Magic is fantastic. I wouldn't even say it's not classic Springsteen sound. It was a contemporary, well, contemporary as he would get, but still a fantastic album. Really, really love that. But the ones that interested me were more like the Pete Seeger project. Well, the Seeger one was definitely the big highlight for me as a Springsteen fan, but Wrecking Ball didn't really do so much for me. Even going back to The Rising, I thought that had a few great classic Springsteen sounding songs,
but I wasn't overly excited. So I was thinking, oh yeah, another Bruce album. And then Western Stars came out, and I just thought it was a thing of beauty. And I know that some people were comparing it to that Laurel Canyon sound of the late 60s. I'm still not completely convinced of that.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sounding record, no matter which way you cut it.
There's no doubt that that's been an influence, that Southern Californian sound, the Jimmy Webb kind of thing.
Yeah.
And for me, it was a really interesting record because it is a different record for Bruce, but I do hear things that he's done before. But I guess as an entire album, it's quite a different sort of Springsteen album. It works together beautifully as an album. And it had me thinking exactly what you've just been talking about. Where does it sort of fit? Is it, it could be his best record since Tunnel of Love, perhaps. I certainly rate Magic, so it'd be right up there with the Magic album. But yeah, just a beautiful record. I saw the movie the other night, and the movie is just wonderful to watch.
Right.
To see him just in this little barn, but with the orchestra. So it's just hearing these songs with the strings, and you go, wow, this would be a great tour. But instead of the tour, we've got the album and the movie. They're great characters. I think he remains rock's greatest storyteller.
And he's a fantastic storyteller.
These are great stories, and it just works as a complete album.
Now, one of the songs on the album, it might have actually been Western Stars, the title track.
Some lost sheep from Oklahoma sips her mojito down at the whiskey bar. Smiles and says she thinks she remembers me from that commercial with a credit card. Hell, these days there ain't no more. Now there's just a gift. Tonight the western stars are shining bright again.
Earlier on this year, saw the release of Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and listening to this song, I thought it could almost have been written about the Leonardo DiCaprio character in that film. He's still someone who finds Hollywood,
perfect.
New Hollywood has left him behind. He's had this career, but no one knows who he is.
Yeah, and he's just, you know, trading off past glories of being in an ad, being in a, you know, a scene with John Wayne. It's really powerful in the movie too, because Bruce obviously talks about that. You know, he's almost equating it to himself to a point. You know, do you strive to be still relevant in the music world? And of course, he's still a huge rock star. But it's interesting, you just sort of see, I guess, a little bit of that insecurity in him talking about that via that song. It's very, very powerful in the movie.
And it's also interesting to see that Springsteen, as this major rock star who still has multitudes of fans, and I'm always reading someone who's put up a post somewhere in Facebook or wherever saying that, well, I never counted myself as a Springsteen fan, but a friend went and took me to a concert, dragged me to a concert, now I'm going out and I'm buying everything. So he still has the power to convert people in that regard. But this, it's a lo-fi sounding album. If not for the fact that there's strings on it, you would have sort of thought, oh, he could have made this on a budget for an indie album or something like that. So the strings would have added some cost. It had a major label behind it, but he's not frightened. He doesn't have to be frightened. He's Springsteen, but he's going out there saying, I'm not going to put out this major stadium album like Wrecking Ball was. I'm going to do a quiet album. And he's done that from time to time since Tunnel of Love, the album that you mentioned. And really, maybe not counting Magic for a second, I'd say this is probably his best album since Tunnel of Love.
Yeah.
I got an occasional co-presenter on the podcast, Davey McLemore, out there in Houston. Hope you're listening, Davey. And he says that Tunnel of Love is just one of the greatest albums ever recorded. He says it's a grown-up's album.
Yeah.
And
it's incredible record.
This is in good company. This is a good, not necessarily a companion piece, because that album is very personal. And this is more him as a storyteller looking from the outside, looking at other people. He's almost like a writer, a great American writer.
Yes.
He could have been an author if he wanted to, but it's a good companion piece that it faces concerns of him through the characters that he talks about as a 60-something-year-old.
Yeah.
He couldn't have made this album in his 30s. Well, maybe he could have, because it's a story it's more relevant.
Yeah, no, it's just a beautiful piece of work, Western Stars. And as I said, no tour this year, maybe a tour next year or early 2021. Fingers crossed. So, yeah, it's been a really exciting year in music. As I said, so many different sort of artists, some, you know, legends like Bruce and Deborah Conway, some new artists like Angie McMahon. We're so lucky being in Melbourne too. We get to see a lot of these acts live. We've lost some legends though this year. I know it would have hit you very, very hard. Chris Wilson, the year started.
That hurt really, really big time. And I don't know whether Sarah is listening to this podcast or not, but Sarah, just, you know, your own music is wonderful, and just I've been following your posts about the absolute love and pride that you have for Fenn and George.
Yeah, Fenn's just put out a fantastic debut album. Yeah.
Two of them are really super talented singers and songwriters and musicians in their own right, so they'll carry on the family business of making great music. But Sarah put out a terrific album a few years ago. The name of the band was Sarah Carroll and the Left Wing. That was an album of really great songwriting, and I think George was playing drums on that or playing guitar, I can't remember. They're all multi-instrumentalists. And
yeah, Chris, such a talented family.
Chris might have put out some harmonica on that, but it was a hard time for all of us as music fans in this town. I mean, we're always seeing every day, and here we are in the early noughts, and all the people who we've grown up, either people who we've seen in our hometown, pass on.
Yeah, so that's been the sad part of the year. And then Damien Lovelock from the Celebrate Rifles we lost this year. Martin Armiger from the Sports and many other great Melbourne bands. Stuart Fraser from Noiseworks. And then just recently, as we talk, Greedy Smith, which has really rocked a lot of people in Australia. Such a loved pop star and such a lovely bloke, and so many hits meant as anything.
I'm reading a lot of people putting out their tributes, and everyone saying the same thing. What a lovely guy he was. What a really straightforward, no bullshit, very happy to be doing the work, and was just one of the nice guys in rock. So
yeah, I was lucky enough to interview him a few times, going way back to when I was just starting out in the late 80s, and just always so welcoming, so warm, so funny, and such a great storyteller. So he will be missed, and tragic that he died. But as they say, you know, he died with his boots on. He was still on the road. He was a couple of days after he died in Sydney, he was due to do a gig in Melbourne, and he had gigs booked right through until next year. Incredibly tragic, but yeah, he just didn't stop touring. He loved it.
I remember hearing a great interview that he did, I think it might have been from earlier on this year, with Brian Nankervis, and they're talking about, you know, probably my favourite metal song, Too Many Times, which he said he wrote while in a hangover. He'd had
in Melbourne, he'd had a huge night out with Swanee.
That's right, yeah.
Jimmy Barnes's brother in Melbourne.
Having some drinks with John Swan. had a hangover, and now's the best time to write a song.
Which is a great song, so certainly check out Too Many Times. Obviously, Live It Up was a massive hit, which Greedy wrote, I think, in Canada. He came up with that song. They were on the road. Yeah, just an extraordinary band in that they had a number of songwriters, and obviously Greedy Smith, one of the singers, Martin Plaza, another great singer and songwriter as well. That meant it was anything, with just jam-packed with talent, and they had 20 top 40 hits in Australia. I was talking to a mate the other night and saying, you know, because I'm such a chart geek, if a band has half a dozen top 40 hits, that's a big band. People know who they are. If a band gets to 9 or 10 top 40 hits, that's huge. You know, that's a really, really big band. Mental as Anything had 20 top 40 hits in Australia, and such a loved band. And we're going to miss Greedy forever.
There was a song which I'd loved for a long time and never knew it was a Mental as Anything song. And I believe that this is something that you played on the radio this week. The World Seems Difficult.
How does it make-
knew that song as the song over the opening credits of probably my favourite Australian film ever, The Big Steal.
Ah, yes, of
and
course.
Then I think Creve Stenders, the director of Red Dog, had put out a tribute on his Facebook page this week, and Creve had directed the video clip for The World Seems Difficult, and he said, like, Greedy had spent 2 days stuck in water up to his waist and never once complained and was like a complete professional. It's a gorgeous song.
Isn't it?
Lovely lyric. And now that I know it's a mental song, it just has even deeper resonance.
Well, it was quite different for a mental song, so I totally get why you didn't think it was, because they did have this, you know, reputation for being wacky and zany and what, you know, and they did have, you know, such a great sense of humour in their songs. The reason I wanted to play that on the radio as a tribute to Greedy was twofold. It's a beautiful song. It sums up what you're sort of feeling after someone dies. You know, the world does seem difficult. But also, that was the single when I first interviewed Greedy. I think it was 1989, and that was the single. And so I remember talking to him about that song. And so it meant a lot to me, and I always just thought it was a great song. One of their top 40 hits. It certainly wasn't a smash hit. But, and also it was produced by our good buddy Mark Opitz as well, who loved Greedy. Didn't do a heap of work with the Mentals, but definitely produced that single.
Doesn't sound like a very Mark Opitz production, though.
No, because he's known as being, you know, the big rock producer in Australia, Cold Chisel, The Angels, The Vinyls, all those incredible bands. But yeah, a really simple, beautiful song. So yeah, I thought that was the perfect tribute to Greedy. But as I said, you could choose many, many songs.
Well, I love that I've discovered now that it's a mental song.
So. Yeah, it's amazing how music sort of does that. That was certainly the sad parts of 2019 for me. But I had a wonderful year personally in that I worked on a Stephen Cummings anthology called A Life is a Life, 4 CDs, 50 tracks.
Another kick in the head, another smack in the mouth, another lonely night. Where were you when I needed you? Where were you when I needed you?
And a wonderful booklet. Credit to the record label Bloodlines who put that together, because it really is a testament to Stephen Cummings, just an extraordinary career he's had, of course, with the sports, but this is focused on his solo work. He's had more than 20 albums. He talked about retiring, but now he's out of retirement. He's going to do some gigs early next year. So that was just an absolute joy working on that. You know, he is just my favourite Australian songwriter.
He's also like a really good general writer. I remember...
Yes, he's done a couple of books.
When it was maybe 10 years ago or so, and my wife Joanne went and pointed this out to me, he was writing throughout the summer every week in The Age
about a swimming pool.
Correct, that's right. Yeah. Really funny and really articulate.
Yeah,
great articles.
Yeah, an extraordinary artist, just remarkably talented, Stephen Cummings. So I loved working on that. Something totally different, I did a little bit of work on a Ronnie Burns anthology as well called This Is Ronnie Burns. For people who might not know, he was a big pop star in the 60s, so around the time of Johnny Farnham and Russell Morris and Normie Rowe, and had a lot of hits in Australia, including a Vietnam War song, Smiley.
Smiley, you're out in the world today. Smiley, you're all on your own. Smiley, hey, the family said to say, wish you were home.
Which Johnny Young wrote. And so just an extraordinary story, Ronnie Burns. He was a big part of Molly's life. Molly lived with the Burns family, so it was sort of like another son. He was in a band called The Flies, who supported the Rolling Stones on their very first Australian tour at the Palais Theatre in Melbourne. And so that was remarkable. But the really interesting thing about this anthology is that it was put out by an English label, Cherry Red, and they were really interested in Ronnie Burns because he had a very close association with the Bee Gees, and quite a remarkable story. And I put together the liner notes for it, so it was great to work with Ronnie on that. And with the Bee Gees, their connection to him, their kind of A&R man, was a guy called Nat Kipner, the father of Steve Kipner, legendary sort of Australian songwriter who found fame in America, wrote Physical for Olivia Newton-John and a stack of other hits. But Nat Kipner was an American serviceman who settled in Australia after World War II and then got into the music industry. And so he was kind of the Bee Gees A&R guy, but also Ronnie Burns' A&R guy. He gets in touch with Ronnie and says, oh, look, I've got these songs. I reckon you could record them. They're really good songs by the Bee Gees. And Ronnie was like, oh, they're just a bunch of kids. Like, what would they have for me? Like, I'm not interested. He got the tape and he went, oh my God, it's like their new Beatles songs. They're just extraordinary. So he flies up to Sydney, is met by the Bee Gees at the airport in this clapped out old combi van. And they said to Ronnie, oh, any chance you could maybe put some, you know, petrol in the van? And Ronnie's like, yeah, sure. But he's thinking, why? I'm your guest. But he said he only realized when he was staying at their house in Sydney, and he realized then just how poor they were. He particularly realized that when they had one guitar between the three of them, and the guitar only had two strings because they couldn't afford to replace the other strings. But he said on those two strings, Barry Gibb had written Spicks and Specks. And he was just like, these guys are geniuses. So he ended up recording, I think, 8 songs written by the Gibb brothers, and they're all on this anthology. And that's why there's a little bit of interest in the UK, because the Bee Gees, I don't have to explain what the Bee Gees went on. They then went back to the UK and were superstars.
Cherry Red is a really good boutique label. They put a lot of work into their packages. So
they did a great job of this anthology. So I really recommend that. If you're interested in that 60s pop sound, this is Ronnie Burns is the name of that. And just finally, my all-time favorite band, Horsehead, they've just released a box set. They existed between 1992 and 2000, did 3 albums, 1 EP. But they were so prolific, particularly in the early days of the band. I went to every gig they ever did in Melbourne. And they would have new songs, and you'd just be blown away going, oh my God. And so what it meant was they just had too many songs for their first couple of albums, but all of those sort of songs have now turned up on this anthology, which a label called Golden Robot did out of Sydney. Just extraordinary work on this. Essentially 2 albums of unreleased Horsehead material, and it just sounds fantastic. So I'm just buzzing with excitement
over
that.
Let me ask you, were they as prolific songwriters as Ed Cooper? Because it seemed like in the 90s,
yeah,
you changed your underwear and Ed Cooper had another album.
Another 2 albums. Yeah, probably not quite. He took it to another level, Ed Cooper. He was like the Slim Dusty of the Australian rock world. But yeah, they were prolific. That were one of those bands, sort of didn't become quite as successful as they deserve, like so many bands. But if you are a Horsehead fan, if you saw a gig, you love them. They're just one of those bands, the hardcore following that they have. People who knew them love them. And they're doing a gig at the Corner Hotel on February 1 in 2020. Their first gig, well, what will it be? It will be 20 years. And so I am beyond excited.
Fantastic. So you're not going, right?
No, I'm busy that night.
Okay.
So, yeah, I won't be there. But no, I'm counting down the days.
I bet.
So it's been a wonderful music year for me for a lot of reasons. New music, but also some old favourites coming back.
Thank you very much. I hope that we get to see each other again before next December. But
whatever happens, lock this in. It's my favourite tradition, Mo. Oh, so thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that I'm still here doing this 8 years later.
Well, likewise, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to episode 129 of Love That Album.
Tables polishing an antique strat that no musician could afford. He's got himself a twin and a pork pie hat. He's got himself a new jazz car.
Back to episode 129 of Love That Album podcast, and on the line we have the author of the incredible Encyclopedia of Australian Rock and Pop, editions 1 and editions 2, Mr. Ian McFarlane. Welcome back to the podcast, Ian.
Oh, good evening. Thanks, Maurice. That's a fantastic introduction. Thank you so much.
We've done a couple of shows together, but also the last 2-3 years, you've also come on at the end to talk about your favourite discoveries of the year or whatnot. So I hand the floor over to you. I'd love to know what has been floating your boat over the last 12 months or so.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for the invite, and it's always good fun to do. I think we've been spoiled for choice with albums this year. I mean, I think I've avoided the obvious pop things and gone for, the... Should I say what a travesty the old awards night was just recently? But there was some good things came out of it. For me, though, one of the best things was the second album by the Teskey Brothers, Run Home Slow.
Hear that rain? Are you crying again?
And of course that won the ARIA Award for Best Group, Best Blues and Roots Album and Engineer of the Year. And what a fabulous band. I love their first album. I've seen them play at least half a dozen times. Run Home Slow doesn't disappoint. You know, they're just such a funky bunch of guys. Soulful, funky, so in the pocket for a band from the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. You know, just young guys, but just a fabulous album, Run Home Slow. And I think there's been quite a number of rootsy albums this year that have kept my attention going, and maybe I'll just run down a quick kind of list, should I?
Absolutely.
Morris? Yeah, well, I think, well, as I said, Run Home Slow would probably be my pick of the albums for the year by the Teskey Brothers. There's also Bonafide by the Soul Movers.
You say that you're leaving, but you don't go. You say that you're leaving, but you stay. You say that you're leaving, so I started grieving. But now I'm only grieving because you stay.
A very funky little ensemble. They recorded overseas and they're recorded in places like Memphis and some of the classic recording studios that the Stax bands and Big Star and all those kind of bands recorded in. And then one of our old guard, Brian Cadd, did a fantastic album this year, Silver City.
Oh, Silver City birthday celebration day. Silver secrets fashion, oh, they go my way. Maybe if I talk to her, then she'll want to.
Called it his Americana album because he recorded that in, I can't remember, was it Nashville or somewhere like that, and just some great American country session musicians, but fantastic songs. He's still a good songwriter.
It's interesting to see that people like himself and Russell Morris have still got a really great creative itch. They've been around for quite a long time and it could have been all too easy for them to sit on their laurels, but it's wonderful to see that they're still actually being creative, writing new material and putting new songs out.
You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, these guys are just, they're just veteran performers, they're good singers, they're good songwriters, they tick all the boxes. So of course they're going to produce really good things. They just have to convince the industry. The fans still love it, but it's the industry that kind of overlooks them. But yeah, Brian Cadd did a great interview with him earlier in the year about the album, and he was so excited that it had come out or that he'd got it done. And yes, that's a good listen. Stephen Cummings' Prisoner of Love was kind of fun.
The wind blew hard and my heart did ache. The wind blew hard and my heart did break.
A little bit sort of laid back, but there's some good tracks on that. Opelousas, fabulous Melbourne band.
I don't need terror has no wings. I don't need, I got you.
And I, we'd be hugging each other on this one. I was always like a big fan of Collard Greens and Gravy and loved Shorty.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, we had him on the podcast November last year. We got to speak when I saw Opelousas at the Wangaratta Festival of Jazz and Blues.
Oh, right.
And I picked up a copy of the CD back then and it blew me away. It's just so gritty. It's a blues supergroup, really. I mean,
Well, Alison Ferrier, I mean, she's just such a sensational guitarist. Kerry Simpson, I mean, what a singer. She's just got that voice, just the power. And even when she whispers, it's got power. And she's got that really deep kind of New Orleans kind of feel to it. But they're a fabulous trio. Another great Roots album is This Is Not a Dream by Los Bragas.
Rolling out in space, such a quiet place. Can't see the human race.
Fabulous musicians once again. Matt Walker, incredible guitar player. That's got some pretty good songs on it. Morning Star, I Am Awakening, which is kind of a very long song. I really like Lucy Thorne's Kitty and Frank.
My sister Biddy came by today, talking what she's talking lately, wondering if she'll go or if she'll stay. So much crying.
Which is her story of Kitty and the bushranger Frank Wilson, I think it is, and their love affair. So she takes the whole story right across from Golden Plains in Victoria to the Barbary Coast. That's quite an interesting listen. And I really dug the Dyson Stringer and Clower album.
Driving through the middle of this white hot heat, competing thoughts I can't complete. I can feel
that's just magnificent, isn't it? I've always liked Mia Dyson. I haven't listened so much to Liz Stringer, and I kind of like Jen Clower, but she's never really blown me away. But the trio of Dyson, Stringer, Clower, fantastic album. There's a song on it called Falling Clouds, which is just incredible. I like that combination. Mm. I liked Nick Cave and the Bad Seed, Ghosteen.
Well, this world is plain to see. It don't mean we can't believe in something. And anyway, my baby's coming back now on the next train.
Very, very minimalist, very, very down piano ballads. There's very little in the way of overpoweringness, which is what Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds had been known for. Maybe he's mellowed a little bit more, but Ghosteen's a very nice listen. And for a bit of the heavy guitar, I really like the Datura 4 album, Blessed Is the Boogie.
Come on in and scrape the shit out the shoes. Open your mind, you got nothing.
The third album, I think, and that's Don Mariani from The Stems and Greg Hitchcock, who's been in bands like The Bamboos and The Monarchs. They've really turned up the amps and the big boogie sounds of things like Blessed Is the Boogie, and they kind of hit a different kind of groove in the last three songs. There's a song called Not For Me, which is kind of like a solo mix of Joe Walsh and Lynyrd Skynyrd, and songs like The City of Light are a bit like an almost heavier kind of West Coast Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, but it's a pretty cool band. They certainly turn up the amps to full.
You say it's got a bit of a bluesy sort of sound. That'd be a little bit different for Don Mariani, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It's normally like with the power pop. That's his signature thing normally.
Oh, absolutely. He said to me, it's just a chance for him to kind of wig out so people don't hold him to his signature sound. He likes turning up the guitar amps as much as anyone, and together he and Greg Hitchcock, the other guitar player, and I can't think of the rhythm section, but they really get it going.
Did you get to see The Stems earlier on this year with Radio Birdman?
No, I didn't. It's been a couple of years since I've seen The Stems. I think one of the classic gigs I ever saw was Stems opening for the Hoodoo Gurus and Radio Birdman about 5 years ago. I have seen those combinations. The last time I saw Birdman was when they did it the year before, when they were supported by Died Pretty. I just love all that sort of stuff.
Now, I was speaking to Jeff the other day, Jeff Jenkins, and he was telling me that the gig, I think last week, with Ron Pino, the audience were just in his back pocket. They welcomed him with open arms, you know, considering, you know, he's had health difficulties over the last year or so, and they just welcomed him back like the conquering hero. It was lovely to hear.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that's great to see that he's still getting out and about. Yeah, I have seen his gig advertised, but yeah, once again, I haven't seen that many. That's my kind of rundown of some of my favourite local albums of the year. I think probably the best compilation reissue this year for me was The Kinks' Arthur, or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire. Come out in a super deluxe 4 CD edition.
I love the original album. I'm not sure if I'm going to go out and buy a 4 CD edition of it, though.
Exactly. Well, look, for those that don't want to go and get the 4 CD edition, there is a 2 CD edition, which is basically the original stereo album remastered with bonus tracks. And then the second CD is called The Great Lost Dave Davies Album, which is basically tracks that he recorded for a proposed solo album, which never came out. But I've had a lot of these tracks on. Like, I've got so many Kink albums, and, you know, going back to the original vinyls. I love the Kinks. They're one of my favourite British 60s or 70s, 70s, 80s bands. I've still got the 2004 reissue series from the Kinks, which already had like a whole bunch of bonus tracks. Anything the Kinks did from Face to Face in 1966 all the way through Village Green Preservation Society, of course, the classic, and Arthur, which was 1969, all the way through Muswell Hillbillies, Everybody's in Show Business and Preservation, and, you know, all the way through to things like Misfits and Low Budget. They're just fantastic. But
I think that some of those 70s albums are sometimes sold short. I don't think that a lot of people tend to care terribly much for anything beyond Muswell Hillbillies. And I rather like albums like Preservation and Soap Opera even. You know,
Soap Opera,
they're not bad albums at all.
Yeah, they probably dip a little bit in quality, but there's always at least two or three absolutely sensational songs on all those albums. But I guess their run from Face to Face in 1966 up to my mind, Everybody's in Show Business in 1972. I mean, just you probably get 10 out of 12 absolutely sensational tracks all the way through. But Arthur is a very interesting album. It's basically one of Dave Davies' kind of concept albums. It's about a guy called Arthur Morgan, who's kind of like a London suburbanite, and, you know, he lived through the war and all that kind of stuff. And he lives in a house called Shangri-La, and he's got a young son and a and they decide to emigrate to Australia. So it's the story is basically the last day of his son in England, and Arthur kind of reflects on his life. I mean, nothing much happens in the story, but it's kind of like he supposedly Arthur thinks, you know, have I led a good life? What's it all about? That whole existential thing in the true Rave Davies fashion. But, I mean, this has got classic songs on it like Victoria and Shangri-La. And Brainwashed is one album. In fact, I've spoken to Tim about the Kinks, you know, some of his favourite songwriters are people like Ray Davies. And I think Tim almost built his whole You or My career around a song like Brainwashed. It's got everything that the You or My have done over the years in terms of the chord structure and the power behind it all and stuff like that.
I've often thought that Hourly Daily sort of sounded to me more like a Kinks album than a Who album. I mean, no, they're often compared to the Who, but but that album has enough texture in it that it's strongly poppy, guitar poppy, but it's got that melodic feel that Ray Davies, I think, was always going for, as well as the power. So, yeah, more of a Kinks influence to my ears, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm pretty sure someone like Tim Rogers would say that. But, yeah, he's got so many influences. It's just one part of it. But I've always liked that album, Arthur, and this, the big Super Deluxe 4CD edition has come out, and it's got demos and rehearsals and remixes and all that kind of stuff as the fourth CD. And anyway, that's a good listen. So that's The Kinks, Arthur, or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire. Say the Arthur or the Decline and Fall of the British Empire, that's the 50th anniversary. So, you know, that came out in 1969. So here we are in 2019. And the same for the band's second album, self-titled album called The Band. That had a big 50th anniversary reissue.
Trees in the meadow. King harvest is surely come.
You know, all these albums have been reissued umpteen times over the years, and they always find a way of getting people to rebuy things with alternate stuff and this and that. And over a matter of weeks, I listened to every band from Music from Big Pink from 1968 in sequence, going through to The Band in 1969, Stage Fright in 1970, Cahoots in 1971, on and on, all the way through, and listened to the entire Last Waltz live album and watched the DVD again, the Martin Scorsese film. Once again, you know, very rootsy, very funky, you know, kind of down-home feel that they had. Amazing songs like The Weight, obviously, that Robbie Robertson wrote, and The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, Life is a Carnival, which is a Robbie Robertson, Rick Danko co-write. They did a lot of stuff with Bob Dylan. I even like some of the later albums like Moondog Matinee, which doesn't always figure in the best band albums. And you can't go past The Last Waltz. Joni Mitchell doing Coyote is just sensational. I just love that.
Why'd you have to get so drunk and lead me on that way? You just picked up a hitcher, prisoner of the white lines on the freeway.
So as well as having listened to all the albums again, I also listened to my band CD box set, which is five CDs and a DVD of live performances from different situations, things from the Festival Express tour in 1970 and playing at Wembley Stadium in London in 1974. So, you know, this is just about everything you would want in a band. It's called The Band, A Musical History.
I lost my way down the line. ain't been back home for some time.
So that's a big 5-CD box, and it's got a massive booklet which tells the whole story of the band. Fabulous photos. There's all the obvious stuff. There's a lot of early material from Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks, Levon and the Hawks, all the way through that sort of stuff to kind of early song sketches from the early days of the band. Then there's alternate kind of early versions and different live versions. There's a live version of a track. They hadn't actually done it on an album, a studio album, but it's a cover of a Dozer Holland track called Don't Do It. Baby Need You Do It, which is just sensational. And they had a horn section.
That was the last song that they performed at the last waltz. But I love the fact that's how they introduce the film. They start off at the end and then they say, right, good night, goodbye. They go through the credits and then they start the concert off after the credits. But I just love, you know, that we'll start the film with the very last thing that they did.
That's why they're so influential, because, you know, the big names like, you know, Eric Clapton and George Harrison always used to say how influential they were. But it's because they played. Robbie Robertson was a sensational guitar player, but he, in the time of Clapton and Hendrick, you know, who wasn't even a guitar hero, but he could play just as good as them. The other thing was that, you know, you had a funky drummer like Levon Helm, who was a very musical drummer in the sense that he knew what to play and when to play, could sing at the same time. They had four separate vocalists who all had completely different vocal styles, and they didn't try and sing harmonies as in true four-part harmony or three-part harmony to make it sound beautiful, which I love harmonies. But what the guys in the band did was they would sing different melodies over the top of each other, different vocals they wouldn't match, you know, they'd kind of go out of phase. But that was just what made it sound so good. You listen to anything like The Wait, when the four or the three different voices come in, they're all sort of over the top of each other rather than harmony, which, you know, is just as effective. I mean, the other thing they had was they had a piano and an organ player. Garth Hudson was the organ player, and they were all multi-instrumentalists. And the number of Australian musicians from the 70s who've told me that the band were one of their big influences is phenomenal. I'll just run off the list. Brian Cadd, Phil Manning from Chain, and Lobby Lloyd, he's told me how much he liked the band. Mel Logan, who played with bands like the Dingoes and Carson. Right. Warren Morgan from Chain and the Aztecs, they all listened to the band. If you listen closely enough to all those musicians, you can hear that influence in a number of different songs. It's maybe not quite as obvious as you would think, but it's there. The other band that was even more so sounded like the band, believe it or not, was Fraternity. Bon Scott was the singer in, and there was a bunch of other musicians. They also had a piano player and an organ player at one point, so some of their records sound like just a match for the band. Bon Scott has that kind of gravelly, less than perfect voice. The music that Fraternity are playing, in some instances, is heavily band influenced. So there you go. I mean, we could go on and on.
So what else have you got for us, Ed?
Before I get on to my discovery of a band I'd never heard before this year, another one of my all-time favourites, and I revisit them on a regular basis, is Fairport Convention and solo Sandy Denny's discography.
She not pulled a double rose, a rose but only two, and up then came young Tamlin, says lady pull no more.
I just love, in particular, the early Fairport Convention stuff, their late 60s into their early to mid 70s albums, when Sandy Denny and Richard Thompson were predominant. I mean, they've had so many different lineups. Trevor Lucas, an Australian singer-songwriter-guitarist, was in the band. He was married to Sandy Denny at one stage. Those later albums that they're on are pretty good, but I particularly like the early Sandy Denny, Richard Thompson kind of era. So, you know, I always revisit them, but in this instance, my biggest discovery in the Sandy Denny discography, she did four solo albums in between, or after she left Fairport Convention, and in between turns of going back to Fairport Convention. So I've got those albums, and I've also got a couple of compilations. one called No More Sad Refrains, which is a double CD compilation.
I've got that one. Yep, it's great. Great compilation.
Fantastic. Yep. Now, I've been listening to that for years. For some reason, you know, because it's a good primer of her material. It's all a lot of her good solo stuff. You know, a lot of good tracks from Fairport Convention. My absolute favourite Sandy Denny vocal of all time is on the Fairport Convention song, Who Knows Where the Time Goes.
I have no thought of time. For who knows where the time goes?
It just stops me in my tracks every time I hear it. No More Sad Refrains is a good primer if you want to get into Sandy Denny. There's stuff from the, as I said, the early Fairport, her band with Trevor Lucas, Fotheringay, her solo stuff from the albums, The North Star, Grassman and the Ravens, Sandy, which was her second album, Like an Old Fashioned Waltz, and Rendezvous was her fourth album before she died. But this is the thing. I'd been listening to this album for years, and it's all of a sudden I'd started listening closely. On the end of disc one, there are two Sandy Denny tracks from an EP soundtrack called Pass of Arm. There's a track called Here in Silence and a track called Man of Iron. And they just blew me away. I just kept listening to them thinking, why haven't I taken any notice of these songs? Morris, do yourself a favour, listen to them. Man of Iron goes for nearly 8 minutes. It's the most haunting folk thing, and Sandy Denny's vocals are just absolutely captivating. Apparently, it was on a little EP from 1972 on the Island label, but it must be super, super rare. I've seen a cover online, picture cover of the EP, but it's supposedly from a movie called Pass of Arms. And if you look on internationalmoviedatabase.com, there's very little information. But having said that, these two Sandy Denny tracks on this soundtrack, which are on this compilation, No More Sad Refrains, are just magnificent. And they're both written by the people involved in this film, Peter Elford and Don Fraser. Sandy's vocals are just phenomenal. So that's my Song of the Year, Man of the Iron by Sandy Denny, which actually was recorded in 1972.
We're all about the discoveries.
Yeah, that's what I like. And but this is what I'm saying. I've been listening to that compilation for ages, and I was, you know, I kind of liked the songs, but then it just for some reason I just kept listening closer and closer and closer, and yeah, that's the one that I definitely can go back to. I mean, and there's just so many magnificent songs on the compilation. So that's another big listening this year, Sandy Denny.
So what's your new discovery of the year, Ian?
Okay. Now, this is a band that formed in London in probably the mid-2000s, 2004 or something. They're a band called Still Corners. A singer called Tessa Murray sings and plays a bit of keys. Multi-instrumentalist, a guy called Greg Hughes, who also predominantly plays guitar and is a producer. And for reference points, or if you want to... I love genres, and a lot of people don't like genres, but you can put them in the dream pop bag. So for reference points, you've got the likes of the Cocteau Twins, Portishead, maybe at a pinch Massive Attack or something like that. And I'm not so much a fan of Portishead or anything like that, but I love the Cocteau Twins. They're one of my favourite English bands from the 80s. I just love that kind of guitar sound they got and the pounding drums and Liz Fraser's vocals. But Still Corners, you know, that might be reference points, Cocteau Twins and the likes, but this is a little bit different. It's a little bit more simple, but a little bit more melancholy. Well, Cocteau Twins are very, very melancholy, but it's more sort of eerie, dream pop, ethereal. Tessa Murray has that kind of mysterious, sort of haunting vocals that you kind of, you know, wonder where they come from. I even read one quote saying that they sounded like something like the Cocteau Twins meets Julie Cruz. Julie Cruz was best known for the track Falling from the Twin Peaks soundtrack.
That's right, yeah.
So that may kind of give you a bit of an idea. I think their early albums and an early EP are more particularly in that kind of Cocteau Twins meet Julie Cruz kind of sound, whereas their third or the second album, they actually recorded two albums for Sub Pop, which is interesting. They had an album called Creatures of an Hour, and then the second album, Strange Pleasures, which came out on Sub Pop in 2013. So by the time they'd got to that album, and then the third album, Dead Blue, and then the fourth album is called Slow Air, they were no longer with Sub Pop, but they'd kind of moved away from the really mysterious kind of Cocteau Twins meet Julie Cruz kind of mode, and a lot more gentle percussion, and a lot more, the songs are a little bit more straighter, if that's kind of the word. But the interesting thing is that I've got hold of their albums and listened to them, but I actually can't listen to a whole album. In this instance, I probably pick just tracks and then just move on. I've never really tended to be a track picker, whereas this is a good example of a band that I'm quite happy just to pick two or three tracks from each of the albums and then just kind of move on, because a lot of the tracks do end up kind of sounding the same. So there's no great revelations. But the first thing that really got me was from their first album, which, well, as I said, I only discovered them this year, so I had to kind of backtrack. The track called Endless Summer. As I said, that's kind of in that Cocteau Twins meets Julie Cruz vein. But then on their second album, Strange Pleasure, there's a track called The Trip. And I should mention, most of the tracks are between 2.5, 3.5 minutes, so they very rarely stray beyond that. But on their second album, the two standout tracks hit the 6-minute mark. There's a track called from Strange Pleasures called The Trip, and then there's another one called Strange Pleasure, or the title track. Just astonishing. So I really like those kind of highlight tracks from each of the albums, and then I can happily, you know, not bother with the rest, listening to the rest of the album. I just go for those tracks and then kind of move on. So it's not something I would play very often, whereas there's a couple of Cocteau Twins albums that over the years I've played to death.
There's a lot of listening recommendations that you've made there, Ian. Hopefully the listeners will go back and discover all the great Australian albums that you've mentioned. Go back through your Kinks and Band Fetish and then Still Corners. There's a lot in there.
I know, by the way of Sandy Denny and the Fairport Convention. I know, it's weird. Look, I don't know. I just don't have any set listening kind of patterns. I still get a lot of value out of local albums. There's a few things that people might want to dip into. I mean, you know, none of this stuff is hard to come by, but, you know, you might not get into them, you know, immediately, whereas, well, in particular, something like Sandy Denny, I just love her vocals. I mean, she's just probably one of my favourite female singers, you know, just the bell-like tone of her vocals. You know, once that kind of gets under your skin, there's absolutely no escape.
She came up through a time, like, in the 70s when there were quite a few really great English female folk singers. And, you know, there were people Jackie McShee and Maddie Pryor. And, you know, I love them both, but definitely I think I'm with you that Sandy Denny was the queen of them all.
It's just the purity of the tone, the emotional input that just, you just wonder where it comes from, how she could be such a good singer. Apparently she was quite a tortured soul in some ways, which a lot of great artists are, but
yeah, I believe anyway. She actually had some strong insecurities, I read.
Insecurities, yes.
Good Lord, if you could step outside your body, listen to that voice the way everyone else who's a fan of you does, I wonder whether those insecurities would still be there. It's just unfathomable to me, because she was a genuine talent.
Absolutely, yeah. Most people would know the fact that she sang a duet with Robert Plant on The Battle of Evermore on Led Zeppelin 4, so maybe some link.
Well, thank you very much for your time again tonight, Ian. So are there any articles that you've been writing of late that the listeners should be having a look out for?
Yeah, Morris, I've been writing a series of articles for Rhythms magazine on and off under the heading of Sounds of the City, with Brian Wise as the editor of Rhythms. That's his big thing, was that he used to listen to the Charlie Gillard show, Sounds of the City, in England in the 70s. And so he kind of got me in on this, I suppose, series of articles where I've looked at landmark venues in Melbourne and things like the TF Much Ballroom, Armstrong Studios, and a few other things like that. So they're the old ones I've done. And I'm just coming up with the next issue of Rhythms magazine is a piece I've done on the iconic Cloudland Ballroom in Brisbane, which is a legendary place that, you know, was originally built for ballroom dancing in the early 40s. And then there was a lot of rock and roll shows at Cloudland and punk shows and things like that. The Clash played there, Midnight Oil played there, you know, all this kind of stuff. Anyway, so that's an article that I've that's coming up in Rhythms magazine. And another one that I've got that'll be published soon in American magazine called Ugly Things, which has been going for about 30 years. And that's always looked at kind of garagey 60s and 70s bands. And I contributed a rather lengthy piece on the Coloured Balls, which will be coming out in the next issue. So that was kind of fun. That was kind of nice to actually get that done. And it'll be published in an American magazine. There seems to be a little bit of a groundswell, a cult following for bands like Coloured Balls these days. The Americans seem to all of a sudden have caught on to, well, not all of a sudden, it's been coming in the last sort of maybe 10 or so years. Bands like the Coloured Balls, the Aztecs and Chain and all sorts of bands. People have started to dip back into that era. Some of the Coloured Balls albums have been reissued by American companies, American independent collector-oriented companies. Yeah, it's a sort of a timely thing that's going to come out in Ugly Things magazine.
Yeah, I mean, Lobby Lord, though, was so influential that probably a lot of modern musicians have been citing that went through their parents' old record collections.
Exactly. The more people hear this sort of stuff, the better, as far as I'm concerned. So it's all good.
Well, once again, thank you so much for your time, Ian. I hope that we get to speak sometime before December of 2020. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Love That Album, episode 129.
Them kill them for the justice of your Jesus, for the service of your
My huge thanks to Jeff Jenkins and Ian McFarlane for being guests on this episode of Love That Album. Hope you decide to follow up on some of their recommendations, both old and new, and that will give you much pleasure, I hope. All right, so the other part of this 2019 first-time listeners' favourite that sort of stuff extravaganza will be out in the last week of December 2019, so sometime between Hanukkah, Christmas and the New Year, and it will feature myself and my son Max Bishtinsky discussing our favourite first-time listens of 2019. I've got a few ideas as to what I might have in that list. It's probably going to be a fairly small list because I'd rather like to keep that a short program. But it'll be hopefully an interesting discussion and maybe some recommendations for things for you people out there to follow up on. If you have any of your own first-time listens that you've heard over 2019, please post them in either to the Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/lovethatalbum or send me an email at rrrkitchen@yahoo.com.au and I'll either read out your email on the next show, or if you want to send in an MP3, then I'll add it to the rest of the program. So for the rest of the month, for the rest of the year, please be nice to each other, and maybe into 2020, please be nice to each other, because the world is in pretty shitty state. I know I say this in a lot of the programs, but yeah, people out there are hurting. I don't want to get political or anything like that, but it's really a bit of a mess. So keep it local, keep it simple, give a loved one a hug, tell them that you love them, and then go play them your favorite record. So I look forward to your company at the end of 2019 in the last week. All the best. Cheers.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.